So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming this morning. How many people, this is their first time? How many people this is their first or second time? That's the same as the people who did the first time. So people who have just been here a couple of times? No, including the ones who were just here today. So how many people are fairly new? This is kind of first or one or two. Forgive me, I'm a little... So meditation, mindfulness, like the instructions I gave earlier, are they easy to, right? The instructions are ultimately so simple, aren't they? And yet there is something difficult about it, isn't it? Our minds have this incredible capacity to be aware and mindful and present. Nothing we have to do, it's already there. And yet, that is very difficult for us. Please don't feel that you're unique. Unfortunately, that wonderful capacity that we all had as infants and toddlers and young children, that was just a natural capacity which we all had and which allowed us to be fairly easygoing and happy and take joy in the simple things and bring a lot of joy to others too, we have lost, many of us, along the way. So meditation is really a return to that capacity we all have. For ease and well-being and happiness, simplicity of life. It is nothing special. And yet there is something, as we approach it in our years later, as I said, that is seemingly so difficult. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. In a very basic way, we are not used to being present to ourselves. And for many of us, that is not easy. And for many, it can be difficult. We are busy people, and we are always going from morning till night. And when we're not going from morning to night, we are involved in various kinds of things to keep us interested, stimulated, etc. So for many of us, being alone with ourselves is not necessarily a comfortable experience. Being alone with our thoughts, being alone with our bodies and its sensations, being alone with our emotions, being alone with our stories and melodramas, in no way being able to act out or distract ourselves, is a new experience. And for many of us, in the beginning, it is uncomfortable. For some, it is highly uncomfortable. but there is no other way. I mean, that's not true. There are other ways. And our society provides us with many, 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 many ways to allow us to feel good in the short run. And yet, as everybody knows, they don't work. They only work in the short run. And if we don't want to keep having to always endlessly stimulate ourselves, distract ourselves, inebriate ourselves, drug ourselves, etc., anesthetize ourselves, at some point we have to be willing to do this very simple thing of just stopping and coming home to ourselves. And even if we find, so to speak, our house is not as neat as we'd like it to be. Our house is not as decorated as we'd like it to be. And for some of us, we may find that our house is a mess. This is our internal house. This is where we need to clean house. This is where we need to straighten up. We are very good at wanting to clean up and straighten up everybody else's mess. And some of us do it quite wisely. And we are always in that mode. But stopping and coming home to our own house and acknowledging our own mess is a little uncomfortable, if not difficult. But that's where we begin. And if you really like your house, but it's a mess. if you really like your house, but it really needs a little redecoration, then that work is joyful. It's not a burden. Many people find their work and their own healing and transformation a burden, something they wish they didn't have to deal with or have to do. But unfortunately, we have to. these body minds are ours. And if we truly want to live at ease and a peaceful mind and open-heartedness and all that good stuff, this work has to be done here, and meditation, mindfulness, is the way to do it. So again, instructions are very simple and easy, but it takes some stick-to-itiveness. It takes some willingness to be uncomfortable. We're not used to being uncomfortable, right? If we're bored, what do? We do something, don't we? Well, because we don't like to be bored. And you know, there is something about meditation that is boring, right? We have to be willing to go through that to find that underneath that there's something quite wonderful within us. But because we are so addicted to stimulation, doing nothing, as opposed to being a joy or a relief, we find it boring. There's nothing going on here, but what? But me. And we find ourselves, the truth, often boring, dull, or somebody we'd rather not hang out with. You know? I mean, when we're doing meditation, that's who we're hanging out with, aren't we? Ourselves. And we may not find that the most pleasant experience. We will over time. But again, if you find it uncomfortable or unpleasant, that's pointing to some kind of division within us. We are not whole. We are not at ease within our own body-mind. If we want to be, then we have to deal with this. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is not just the piece I was talking about, but there is just the piece that our minds are, you know, we have spent our life often living in our thoughts. That's where we hang out. That's where we're focuses. We are not present to life. We're not present to what's going on in the moment. We're not in whatever the activity is. We are thinking. And we're not just only thinking about what's right there in front of us, but we're thinking about, you know, what's gone on. And that capacity of the mind to think about what goes on, has gone on, can be what's gone on an hour ago, or what's gone on a day ago, or what's gone on a year. I mean, the mind can go anywhere, can't it? And if it's not even thinking about what's going on in one's own life, one can think about what's gone on in other people's lives, right? And we do the same thing about the future. Always endlessly planning, worrying, anticipating, expecting, right? And, you know, again, and on and on and on and on. So we are lost in thought. We are not present to life, we are lost in thought. And so when we sit down to do something as simple as what? I mean, what could be simpler than being present to our bodies and our breath, right? Oh, many people then get frustrated because when you sit down, we can't even do that, right? In beginning of breath meditation, there's a very simple exercise of just counting your breath from 1 to 10, right? Maybe many of you are familiar with that. Just counting your breath, 1, 2, 3, 4, right? Up to 10. And when you get to 10, what do? You start at 1 again. Now, what could be easier than that? We'll try it sometime. Many people never get to 10. Or many people find themselves at 25. Because the deal in that meditative kind of exercise is if you find that you've gotten distracted, you have to begin again at 10. I mean at 1. So therefore, why is that? I remember thousands of years ago, starting out, quite humbling for many of us, with all our education, we were unable to count from 1 to 10. It's a humbling experience, but for some people it can be frustrating. Because again, we sit down with an expectation of how we're supposed to be, how our mind's supposed to be, what we want to accomplish, and it doesn't work that way, right? Another example of life not being the way I want it to be. In this case, my mind is not what I want it to be. My meditation is not what I want it to be. And so again, we get frustrated rather than easing up, rather than accepting, relaxing, and working from the inside with learning to develop a relationship with our minds, which involves, unfortunately, a bit of looking at why am I so obsessed with my thoughts? Why am I so obsessed with the dramas and the melodramas of my life and everybody's life? And yet so uncomfortable with just being in the moment with myself and with whatever's going on. So again, this is the journey. Many people make the spiritual journey into something mystical or esoteric or full of symbolism and altered states. But that's part of the distraction. That's not the spiritual journey. The spiritual journey is about waking up to the reality and the wonderment of what's right here. And getting all the things that are in the way out of the way. When it's understood that way, then it's understood that that is within the capacity of all of us. Because all we have to be is who we are. I mean, what could be simpler than that? Since we already are who we are. We just have wandered away in our world of identifications. As was recited earlier, lost in the world of complexes. Superiority, inferiority, or quality. We were all children once. We were all little children. We didn't have complexes. We have to remember that, because we think all our complexes, all our neuroses, all our issues is who we are. We forget, before all this stuff occurred, we were fine. We were whole, and we were present to life. All these complexes, neuroses, issues that we have developed over time. But like the prodigal son who journeys far from home and has forgotten that he is the heir to a fortune, we have forgotten who and what we really are. And we identify with this other person with all their issues, with all their complexes and complexities that we're always trying to fix, that we're always trying to figure out. And like the, what's his name, you know, the boy is putting his finger in the dike. As soon as we figure out one, all of a sudden we have another one to figure out. As soon as we've worked our way out of one, you know, we have a little rest, and then we got to work our way out of the other. So for those of you, any questions about that? Anybody see it differently? Or anybody not understand what's being presented? Please don't be shy, even if you're new. What we've been working on these last couple of months, both in my presentations, the presentations of other people who have been presenting on Sunday, as well as in these practice, these intensives and these other things that many of us are involved in, we've been looking at some of the fundamental teachings of the Buddha. The kind of fundamental teachings that many people would say, oh, I understand that. But we've been taking a different kind of look at it and realizing that intellectually understanding something or being able to converse about something, that doesn't mean we really know it, right? I mean, so is the sky above us? And everybody here would say, yeah, the sky's still there. But how many of us stop to see the sky? We'd say, oh yeah, I know there are trees and flowers about. And, yeah. But how many of us, as we rush around in our busy life, actually make contact with the trees and the flowers and the earth? Right? We may say, oh yeah, I know I live with this person and I work with these people and I have this relationship and that. But often again, we don't stop to really be present to these things. So we really know them, not just as thoughts, not just as objects, but as something deeply personal. So in the same way, we're trying to get to know these teachings, these very fundamental teachings of Buddhism, that again, intellectually, it can not that difficult to understand, but if they're really reflected on and taken into deeply, have the power to transform us. They are the view, they are the enlightened view of an awakened one, the Buddha, or other. Anybody in here who's awakened will see it the same way. It's just the way things are. And the only advantage we have is because of those who've gone before us, with their awakening, have taken the time to kind of share the way they see things, to share it with us, so we don't have to continually make the same mistakes. And we've been working with several texts. This one I'm referring to this week is called Words of My Perfect Teacher. I won't go into him. For those who are interested, past talks are available on the website and they can be listened to. Last week, we looked at two of the teachings, and again, they've all been dealt with over these months, but in this book, The Preciousness of Human Life, there's a whole chapter, and again, what I referred to last week, so after the end of this whole chapter with Patrick Rinpoche explaining the preciousness of human life and the advantages and all that, you know, backwards and forwards in any possible way he could to wake us up, at the end of this he had that verse, and again, I won't comment on it, I'll just share it because you can listen to last week's. He says, although I have won these freedoms, I am poor in Dharma, which is their essence. Although I have entered the Dharma, I waste time doing other things. Bless me and foolish beings like me, that we may attain the very essence of freedoms and advantages. And again, he's just acknowledging that there's so many things we go, oh, I know that. Oh, I understand that. And yet, it doesn't go below here because it hasn't really transformed our really way of seeing and viewing ourselves in life that really makes a significant difference. And so after, you know, in the same way, there's this wonderful, again, long involved chapter on impermanence. He explains impermanence every which way so we would get it. And at the end of which he says, impermanence is everywhere, yet I think things will last. I have reached the gates of old age, yet I still pretend I am young. Bless me and misguided beings like me, that we may truly, truly understand impermanence. So those are the verses that I commented on last week. I want to go on to the next two. So the next of reflection is called the defects of samsara. This is an interesting one. And let me just say a few things about it. Because we are lay people. We are people in the world. We are people with jobs and families and relationships and the whole deal. Or as John Kabat-Zinn said in one of his first books, the full catastrophe. We are all in the full catastrophe of life. And so samsara is a Sanskrit word. It sort of refers to the world of change, this world we all live in, the relative world, this world that is impermanent, this world that is not solid, this world that is always changing, this world of duality. Things are up and down, and gain and loss, pain and pleasure, like and dislike, happiness and sadness. This world of endless opposites. This is this world of what's called samsara. It's often referred to as a world of birth and death. Things are just, right? Things are just being born. This meditation this morning, it had a beginning, it'll have a middle, and it'll end. We can say even this meditation will have a birth and a death. Every word I speak, it has a birth, and then it's gone, it's dead. So everything is subject to this world of this change. So this is the world of samsara. Now, when this chapter is called The Defects of Samsara, right? So since this is the world we live in, right? The world we see, the way we're involved with, and it's the world that we want to, you know, we want to find happiness in. We want to be happy, we want to be loving, we want to be open-hearted, we want to have a peaceful mind, right? So it's in this world that we want to achieve all these things, right? That's why we work so hard. That's why we endlessly work so hard, and we're always trying to improve ourselves and fix things and get it right and get this and get that and buy this and buy that and change. Because at the end of the day, we want to be what? What do you want to be? What? Happy. I mean, it's so simple. All this work is about one thing, right? We want to be happy. Happiness is an inner state. It's a state of kind of well-being, ease. You know, it's not necessarily the happiness when we laugh at a joke, right? It's a different kind of happiness. It's a deeper sense of well-being and ease in life and open-heartedness and warmth. I mean, right? We'd like to be happy. And so we zoom around doing all these things. Right? Because we, at the end of the day, hope it'll all come together and we will be happy. I mean, am I right? I mean, even if we're wanting a new car, and even if we're wanting, I mean, there are a lot of practical things, but we really think if we get it, we'll be happy. If I get this job, if I get this relationship, if the relationship works out the way I want, I mean, if all this, then I will be what? Happy. If I get a certain amount of money, then I'll be happy. If I have a certain kind of body, then I'll be happy. If I look a certain way, then I'll be happy. If other people like me, then I'll be happy. You know what I mean? So if we kind of make it very simple, at the end of the day, why are we doing all this? You know, if we get it all together, and we're all trying to get it together, right? We're all trying to get it right, trying to get it right and perfect and worked out, and so we can be happy. Now this is important. He says, this chapter is called The Defects of Samsara. So we should pay close attention. Because what he seems to be implying, that there is a defect in all this. Right? Like there's a flaw in all this. And so therefore it's never going to work right. And you know what? Everybody in here knows that. Everybody in here knows that at some level. But it's kind of bad form to talk about it, right? You know, it's kind of, who wants to be around somebody like that? Mm-hmm. But that's actually what the Buddha did. And that's what the teachers and the masters are doing. They're trying to point something out to us. And what the fundamental defect of all this world of change, of impermanence, of non-solidity, of up and down and back and forth, and gain and loss and like and dislike, is it's in it. Because of that, nothing of permanent kind of happiness or inner peace can ever be found. Ever be found. It doesn't mean when things go our way, we're not happy, right? How are we when things go our way? We're happy. Things are going my way, right? Unfortunately, they don't always go our way, do they? So when things don't go our way, how are we? Not happy. Right? When people are treating us the way we want or acting the way we want them to act, how are we? We're happy. But when people are not treating us the way we want and not acting the way we want, how are we? We're pissed. We're not happy. We're hurt. Right? Right? When things are, when we are successful at whatever activities we're doing, how are we? Happy. When we perceive we're unsuccessful at whatever we're trying to do, how are we? Unhappy. When we feel that people like us and respect us, how are we? Happy. When we perceive people don't like us, rejecting us, how are we? Unhappy. When our bodies feel healthy, how are we? When our bodies are unhealthy, how are we? Yeah. So, I mean, do I need to go on? You see, can you see the problem? You see, that's what they're pointing out. There's a fundamental problem in all this. This life inherently is unstable, that's all. That its nature is to go up and down, back and forth. You can't ever get it perfectly. I mean, even if you have $56 billion and live in a 50,000 square foot home and everybody in the world thinks you're wonderful, you're still going to get sick and die. Right? I mean, you know, I feel bad even saying that out loud. But unfortunately, the multi-billionaires of this world and the poor homeless people of this world share that same fact. Right. Now, looking at that, and we, you know, and he goes on. I mean, people who have read this realize Patrick Boucher makes a very strong case for this. Now, there are traditionally two ways of responding to this when you really see it. One way is, we could say, is the path of renunciation, which would be what? I'm out of here, right? I'm going to live off the grid. I'm going to go some nice and lead a little simple life, you know, keep it as simple as possible and have nothing to do with this mess. Right? Now, that traditionally, people who became monks and nuns and hermits and people like that, that would be their response. But people like us, we don't do that, do we? This is our life, right? This up and down and back and forth and like and dislike, success and failure, pleasure, pain, you know, the whole deal. This is our life, right? We are in the middle of it. Right. So, what do? Do you? I mean, is everybody with me? See, that's our dilemma. Right. The we're in it. We're knee deep in it. Right. And we still want to be happy. Not just up and down happy. Not just back and forth happy. Not just drug induced happy. But we want a we want the genuine product. So, What we have to do is to understand that fact, so we can live in this world of up and down, back and forth, like and dislike, and not be emotionally always disturbed by it. Because what we want is a happiness and a well-being and a peace of mind that is not dependent on this. Right? Now again, we know this. You see, there's something, I mean, I'm just thinking what comes to mind, you know, there's like, maybe people know there's this word codependency, right? Anybody ever hear that word? Yeah, it's a very popular word. I mean, basically a codependent person is what? They are dependent on their happiness on what? On the other people, right? Many of us are like that. Our happiness is dependent on other people, whether they like me or dislike me, how they treat me or don't treat me, whether how they're doing, you know, whether they're in my life or not. So that is a happiness that is not anywhere within me. It is a happiness that's totally dependent on the external situations. And that external situation I cannot control. Like I cannot control the weather, can I? If my happiness is dependent on every day being a beautiful day around mid-70s, right? I guess I could move to San Diego or something, but, you know, generally I have to accept that things change. And I don't want my happiness or unhappiness pegged to the weather. I mean, we'd say that'd be crazy, wouldn't it? And yet we do it with everything else in life. So what we want is to be able to live in this world, you know, and when there's happiness, be happy, when there's sadness, be sad, and when good things happen, we feel good, and when bad things happen, we're okay, because we understand that's just the way it is. In Buddhism, that's called equanimity, an equanimous mind. It lives in the world, is up and down and back and forth, but it's not disturbed. Why is it not disturbed? Because it understands that this is the nature of the world, but it is also cultivating an inner life. Because this is the other piece, that through the development of mindfulness and awareness, through learning to cultivate meditation, and through having a correct view of things, one can have a consistent state of well-being and happiness that is not dependent on externals. This is so important. That we understand the defect is not in me. The defect is in thinking that the product is going to deliver happiness to me, well-being to me. There are many people in our culture that when they get unhappy with life, or they feel depressed or anxious and all these things, they think it's because there's something wrong with me. But actually, a lot of that disillusionment is coming because of we're trying to get something out here that cannot be gotten. But it's hard to face that fact because everybody is telling us what? There's something wrong with me. So you need to take a pill. You need to have a drink. You need to get high and kind of see things the way they really are. So at the end of this whole chapter in the defects of samsara, Patrick Rinpoche writes this little verse. He says, I see that samsara, you know, is suffering, but crave it still. I fear the abyss of the lower realms. Lower realms means a kind of life that is painful. I fear the abyss of the lower realms, but continue to do wrong. In other words, continue to do actions that create that kind of life for myself. Bless me and those who've gone astray like me, that we may sincerely renounce the things of this life. And again, renounce doesn't please. I'm just saying this. Doesn't mean you're going to go home and sell your house and your car, you know, and leave your job and all your relationships. It means renounce these things as a permanent source of happiness. If you see the person you're in relationship as the source of your happiness, you're in big trouble. Has anybody noticed that? Now that doesn't mean that the person you're in relationship with cannot be a source of happiness for you, right? That relationships cannot be a source of happiness. But if you are dependent on that person to be your source of happiness, you're in big trouble. Why is that? Why is that? Is there something wrong with them? No. It's because why? Well, there's two reasons. One is they have their own stuff. Sorry, they can't be there for you 100% all the time just the way you want it. Right? Because, and this may be a shock to some of us, they want the same thing from us. See, many people don't get that. Right? Can you see why there might be some problems with that? Yeah. And two, happiness is an inner state. We don't get happy out here, do we? We get happy in here. I mean, I say this and we all go, oh, I understand that. But we don't understand it, right? Everybody says, oh yeah, happiness isn't inside. And then we continue to, you know, run around life trying to get happiness from things outside us. We don't stop to go, what's really being said here? Because if we get it, you know, we would stop this endless manipulation of life to get what we want, because we think that'll bring us what? Happiness. Happiness is, as we all know, in our saner moments, happiness is something that occurs in my own body-mind. I'm going to say that again. Happiness is something that occurs within my own body-mind. See, Brian over here, he can't get in there, can he? Even if he wanted to. Huh? And I can't get in there. Because happiness is, or unhappiness is going on where? Yeah, inside. When we understand that, and conversely we understand unhappiness, suffering, sadness, anger, fear, where is that all going on? In our minds. That's where it's going on. All the melodramas that we think are going on in our life, where are they going on? In our minds. Life is just simply unfolding. A melodrama is when life is unfolding the way we don't want it to unfold, and we start getting a lot of, we got agitated. We get very emotional. But that's all that's going on. I see that samsara is suffering, but crave it still. It's kind of like addiction. Many addicts know that their activity is causing pain to themselves and others, and yet they still crave it. Why? Well, one, because maybe they're still addicted. We have to acknowledge maybe we're still addicted. But also, do not know another way. A spiritual path is showing us another way. That's what a spiritual path is about. It's not just something to read. It's not a way of dressing, smelling, looking, talking. A spiritual path is showing us another way how to live, another way how to be. Why? For only one reason. So we can truly be happy, and we can truly create happy relationships, right? And lead a meaningful, good life. And that's what we want. That's what a spiritual path should give us. If it's not giving it to us, then something's not right. I see some sorrow is suffering, but crave it still. Right? And this is the great teacher saying this. This is his verse at the end. I fear the abyss of the lower realms. Meaning, again, you know, how many of us enjoy entering the realm of anger? Resentment. Right? How many of us like and enjoy entering the realm of despair and sadness and hurt? How many of us enjoy entering the realm of fear and terror? I mean, is there anybody here who says, yeah, I really enjoy that? Nothing do I look forward to than just being pissed all day. It's humorous, isn't it? And yet the truth is what? I fear the abyss of the lower realms, but I continue to do wrong. Means that I continue to do actions in my body, speech, and mind that create this. Bless me and those who've gone astray like me, that we may sincerely renounce the things of this life. And again, this doesn't mean physically renouncing them. It means renouncing them as a source of intrinsic happiness and well-being. Why? Because we see the defect in the product. It cannot deliver what we want. That doesn't mean get rid of the product and go get a new product. That's what we do. Get a new job, new relationship, new hairstyle, you know, new look. No, that's not going to do it. It'll do that, but it won't give us happiness. And you all know that, don't we? We all know that. But we just have to be willing to take the look and see the implications of what we're doing. So that's the verse on that chapter. And then let me just read the verse on the fourth chapter, which is there are these four fundamental reflections on the preciousness of human life, on the impermanence, on the defects, and then on karma, cause and effect. And again, at the end of a long chapter on actions, cause and effect, where it really lays out how cause and effect is simply the law of life. Action and reaction. Why do things happen? Because of this, because of that. For every action, there is a prior cause or causes or variables that are all involved in creating that moment. Now, again, the study of karma is very important. It takes the person out of it. It takes the blame out of it. It takes the confusion out of it. You know, why am I the way I am? Well, if you understand my childhood, my upbringing, my parents, the environment, all my experiences, you would say what? Oh, now I understand clearly why he is the way he is. Right? Why do I have the mind I have with the thoughts, feelings, perceptions? It's only because, of history. And each of us have that. Why am I the way I am? Why do I feel the way I am? Why do I do what I do? Well, because of all the cause and effects that come from all your prior experiences in this life. If you understand all them, you'll understand perfectly why you are the way you are. And also you'd understand perfectly why the person you're so angry at is the way they are. And how they can't help themselves being who they are. The same way we in this moment cannot help ourselves being who they want. They cannot help themselves, as well as the whole world can't help itself. Why is the world in the mess it's in? Take a look around. It's us. The world is created by us and our actions. So karma is one way we understand, get out of the personalization, get into some deeper kind of understanding. But also karma also is the freedom to understand that therefore things can change. Since everything is impermanent, nothing is stable, and this impermanent and stable world is operating under very simple laws of cause and effect. If I want to be a different person, if I want to have a different mind, if I want a different world, then I need to make we need to make different causes. Different causes will create different effects. So karma, you know, this is very simple here, is a very important key to understanding why things are the way they are, so we're no longer angry or disappointed and all that stuff. But as well as it lets us know that personally, interpersonally, societally, things can change. Things can change dramatically, but only if we change and change dramatically. So at the end of all this chapter, kind of I'm just summarizing, Pachu Rinpoche, his final verse is, I know all the details of karma, but I do not really believe in it. I have heard a lot of dharma. Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha. He said, I have heard a lot of dharma, but never put it into practice. Bless me and evildoers like me, that our minds may mingle with the Dharma. Right? So here he's a great master and all that, and yet he goes, he knows us. You know, I understand karma, cause and effect, but I don't really believe in it, because if I really believed in it, I would be at peace. See, all these teachings give us peace. If we understand impermanence and the nature of everything to change, we would no longer be upset, scared, frustrated when change occurs, big change or small change. We understand everything changes, nothing is stable. Right? All that emotionality around change would cease. If we understand cause and effect, we would understand clearly, why do things change? Because of causes. That's all. Nothing personal here. If we understood the defects of samsara, we would not be always grasping at it for happiness and then disappointed when it doesn't turn out the way we want it. So if we understood all these Dharma teachings, our minds would be at peace. I know all the details of karma, but I do not really believe it. I have heard a lot of Dharma, but never put it into practice. We know that, don't we? I mean, the wisdom in this group here today, if we put all the books we've read, all the things that have meant something to us, right? We have enough wisdom and understanding, insight in this room, to enlighten the world, don't we? And yet what? Even though we know it all this, we still don't practice it. Right? Isn't that the truth? Yeah. How do we know that? Because if we practiced it, we would be free. We would be free of emotional affliction. Our minds would be at ease. Right? That's the truth, isn't it? Bless me and evildoers like me. he's saying what? Evildoers mean what? That even though we have this great capacity for goodness and skillfulness, we still don't follow the truth of what we know. In that sense, we do evil. We do evil to who? To ourselves. To our inner knowing, to our inner better sense of who and what we are and what our life is capable of. Bless me and evildoers like me, that our minds may mingle with Dharma. Dharma, we could say, these refer to the teachings of the Buddha, but they really mean any teaching. A Dharma is any teaching that shows, teaches how life really is and how to really live in harmony with life. That's Dharma. And it says, may my mind mingle with Dharma. It's a beautiful phrase, because for many of us, we're here in our minds, and then there is this body of spiritual teaching, right? There's us and it. And we're always trying to kind of, now what is that? There are five of those or three of those, or, which... You know, which teaching applies to this situation? You know what I mean? Which, it's sort of like, Dharma is our toolbox, and every time we got a problem, we're trying to remember now which. Now, what do you use? A hammer, or what kind of hammer do you use here? And, you know, it's always, we're always having to get our manual, sort of like that. Right? May my mind mingle with Dharma, which means what? It's inside me. I understand that. It's become my own way of viewing things. Right? So we want, that's how we know we're getting somewhere, where we're no longer grasping at the teachings. We're no longer always having to check in the manual what to do. How do I get out of this one? Right? Let me remember, which teaching gets you out of this one? Oh, letting go, that's right. Letting go, that's right. Acceptance, that's right. Seeing things as they are. Stop controlling. You know, we're always giving instructions to ourselves. Be understanding. Oh, see the other person's point of view. Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, that's one. Yeah. See that perhaps the other person is suffering too. Oh, wow, I completely forgot about that one. May my mind mingle with Dharma. That's what it means. But no longer are we having, you know, it's a process. I mean, in the beginning, what? In Buddhism, we say, hear the teachings, reflect on the teachings, practice. Right? So that's, I mean, don't feel bad. I mean, that's the process. First we hear, we read, we come to Dharma talks like this, we hear the teachings. Then we need to reflect on it deeply. Digest it. What does it really mean? What's really said? How does that affect my life? What does this really mean for me? And then if that's all working, then I need to practice. And it's only in the practicing that the mingling occurs. Good. So why don't we take any questions or comments? We have a few minutes. This is simple but big. I mean, is anything not clear about what this is about or how to practice? Please don't be shy. This is important. Anything not clear? Anybody want to make a comment? Yes.
I can make a comment, Fred. Thank you for the teaching. I've heard you say this before, but as with most of the teachings, they impact over time and they get repeated. But, you know, we talk a lot about knowledge, but you don't hear people talk about wisdom that often. And maybe that's because we associate that with age. And I'm more sensitive to that as I get older. Mm-hmm. But I've heard you say this before, and today for some reason it came up when you were speaking, but you said wisdom comes from the distillation of direct experience. Mm-hmm. And that to me is very meaningful.
Yeah. There is a knowing. We all know that. At some point you just know something. You know something's right and you know something's wrong. Right? You know something's good, you know something's not good. We know it. Right? And that's not, you know, you can think your way into not knowing. But there's a knowing. And often that knowing is coming from a deeper place. You know, Buddhism teaches, the Buddha taught, and that we all have this Buddha nature. It's not something we have to create. It's not something we have to make. It's not even something we have to find. It's already inherently, intrinsically in our minds, a knowing. And yet we have covered it with this intellectual, conceptual gobbledygook, endlessly projecting, endlessly confabulating. And so we've lost touch with this inherent wisdom. Often our true mind is called the all-good mind. It's the seat of all goodness. Right? When you have a... we all know that we have at times, just naturally, done good, wanted to be of help, helped another human being, done the right thing, not done harm. Well, why do we do that? Where does that come from? Right? You don't find that so much in the animal realm, do you? But human beings have this incredible capacity, this all good mind that we were born with, but we have lost touch with it. But yet it still comes up, because that's why we're here. We may not know it, but that's why we're here today. Because somehow there's a knowing that there is another way in this life. And a part of us wants that. Again, but we live in a culture where that those seeds are not nourished. Right? And we are, because the message of our culture is, there are no defects in samsara, right? You just haven't consumed enough. You haven't gotten the right product, the right job, the right relationship, the right hairstyle, right? That's the problem. And so those are very powerful messages, right? So we have, so that's why we need this, because it touches something else in us. And I think many of us, when we stop, we know that there's a truth in this. But again, you know, many of us, like Padre Rinpoche says, as soon as we leave here today, we'll get up, go back out to our lives, and another week will pass. Even though I know better, I still continue to go down the same old roads. Right? But one day, slowly, we wake up. Unfortunately, the books, the teachers, even the friends, spiritual friends, can't wake us up. They can only help and support. But that waking up is in our own hands. So there's a certain level of courage that is needed in each of us. Because in a certain way, we are going against the current a little bit. Nobody has to know it. But internally, we're going against the current. Right? It's sort of like, if you remember your childhood stories, you know, the Emperor's New Clothes. Right? Everybody remember the Emperor's New Clothes, right? I mean, everybody's going what? Well, the Emperor's got the most handsome suit of clothes on, right? You remember that? Everybody's oohing and aahing. Including the Emperor, he thinks he's got a beautiful suit of clothes on. And everybody around him is saying he's got a beautiful... The whole crowd in the parade, everybody's saying, who sees the truth? Do you remember? A child, why? Because his mind is pure. He can see things as they really are. And he says the Emperor's naked. The Buddha's teaching is like that. It's like that. And again, most people are saying the Emperor's got the most beautiful suit of clothes on. Anyhow, we will stop now. Thank you.